Hello for your Harambe listeners. This is your host, Baye Kemet, with our show, The Liberated Zone. And The Liberated Zone is a space where Africans are free to articulate their paradigms of practice, their philosophies, and their ideologies. Tonight, my guest is Dr. Kwesi Konadu. Brother Kwesi, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, Asante, I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right, great. Before I begin, I just wanted to give the listeners some brief information. First of all, tomorrow evening from 7 to 10, there will be a show on the brother Ken Bridges from Mata Networks, who was killed during the D.C. sniper incident. And so if the listeners can check out that show, be greatly appreciated. And I know it's going to be a wonderful show. And the brother Mata Network, you know, had his work had extended throughout the country and throughout the world. Actually, his products are still still in use in my household. I know one of the brothers who were making the African clocks that are still hanging in our house. So, you know, we definitely want to have our listeners check out the show. Okay, Brother Kwesi, want to very quickly before we begin just read a brief bio on you. Kwesi Konadu was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and his maternal lineage include both Maroon and Akan ancestry. He attended graduate school at Cornell University and Howard University and received his PhD in African Studies. Dr. Konadu specializes in Akan, West African, and African diasporic history. His books include Indigenous Medicine and Knowledge in African Society, A View from the East, Black Cultural Nationalism and Education in New York City, and the forthcoming The Akan Diaspora in the Americas. And again, I want to welcome all my listeners to my host tonight, Brother Kwesi. So, Brother Kwesi, before we begin, as we begin, please, any opening words that you would like to add onto the show before I begin to bombard you with a list of questions here so we can pick your brain for the night?
Well, I'll let the questions start.
All right, Ashe.
We can take it from there.
Well, I want to let my listeners know that my relationship with Kwesi actually began when the Garvey School, Egun Omade Shule, became members of the Council of Independent Black Institutions in 2003. And at the time, Kwesi, along with Sister Ya Asantua, were the co-executive officers of the Council of Independent Black Institutions. And Kwesi and I developed a relationship through talking about CB and talking about ways that we can advance the organization and what have you. And so throughout that time period, I would call Kwesi would call me, and we would continue to exchange ideas. And over the time, our relationship began to grow to a more personal relationship. And I recall a few years ago, you published a book called Truth Crushed to the Earth Will Rise Again, which for me is like the Bible when it comes to African-centered education. And I always tell you that. And I believe it's chapter 5, which is Imani. I could be mistaken about that, but that one chapter in the one book, which is not necessarily greater or better than any other chapters, but it's one chapter that I always refer to on that particular book, which is sort of a in-depth analysis of what African-centered education is, and it gives a very thorough definition of it and begins to break down CB's definition of it and what have you. But overall, the book itself is a monolith in terms of, you know, African-centered education and the history of the East organization. So I just want to ask you, starting out, man, can you talk a little bit about your history or connection to the Council of Independent Institutions and how that has helped broaden your, I guess, your larger research projects that you're working on, that you've completed and that you're working on now?
Well, certainly, and definitely appreciate the kind words by you.
Sure.
You know, much like how our relationship had developed through the Council of Independent Black Institutions, which we affectionately call CB, my research actually began through that same council when Mwalimu Shuja was the executive officer. I remember when I was in graduate school at Cornell, I was searching through books, archives, and notes, and trying to really settle on what would be my thesis topic. And at the same time, I was introduced to the Council of Indian Black Institution in an article in Ebony Magazine. It was a one-page article, a brief article, but I remember that the article mentioned CB and had a website for it at the time. So that was my entry point. And from there on, I chose to look at what became the flagship for the East organization, which was Uhuru Sasashule, or Freedom Now School. And I came to find out that Uhuru Sasashule was much, much larger than I anticipated. In fact, my Kiswahili instructor then, Mwalimu Nanji, who was an instructor at Cornell, his child actually went through Uhuru Sasashule. So it gave me, you know, a personal connection and a, you know, a bond to CB by looking at its history without even realizing it. And, you know, as you know, you start to read and look into the notes. You do the archival research, you do the interviews, and you get into people's lives. And before you know it, you know, history takes its course, and you become a part of people's lives. This way, I not only have, I think, a very substantial relationship with you, many of the elders who are part of CB, their families, but also many of the families who are part of the East. Even today, I have a very strong relationship with Jitu Ayusi, who was one of the most central figures in organizing the East under Uhuru Sasa. So I think the research actually came about as a result of a convergence between my own personal interest, CB's history, Uhuru Sasa and the East's history, and then I think the larger, I think, thrust for a kind of cultural context for education among people of African ancestry in this country.
All right. And so, in doing your research for the East organization, I mean, what were some of the, I guess, larger compelling things that you know, going into the research project, you did not anticipate either learning or having to expound upon, but that really rings a bell in looking back at the project?
Well, that's a very good question, because I try not to set expectations when I begin any project, because usually when you do that in research or life, it's usually a recipe for some kind of disappointment, because life and research doesn't work that way. That is, it usually doesn't work out in terms of how you would, you know, plan it out in your head. And so I didn't really have much expectation, but, you know, as the project developed from a 10-page proposal, which I had to submit to the director for the Africana Center at Cornell, and then, of course, my proposal for the research itself, it kind of really grew from the Ocean of Brownsville confrontation in New York City, particularly in Brooklyn in this case, over community-controlled schools. And I remember doing a research paper on Ocean and Brownsville, and from there I began to see the actors, Jitu Ayusi, Al Vann, Preston Wilcox, a lot of the key figures who, you know, came to define the movement at the time, and also those who would actually begin to forge or become CB in 1972 down in South Carolina. And so, you know, as the project grew, I really just unfolded into other people's worlds, their lives, their stories. And I think one of the most compelling themes was about, you know, the ways in which leadership of organization is key to, you know, sustaining and, I think, navigating any organization through its own life cycles. I saw that the East made some very important, you know, steps to put in place structures and strategies to ensure leadership continuity. However, it was such a very, you know foresightful kind of endeavor. They failed to put their own people in the driver's seat. So it's almost like, metaphorically, you know, you actually, you know, by hand and scratch, you build a car together with your own ingenuity, but you put someone else in the driver's seat.
Right.
And I saw that as being fatal to the East. Now, I won't name names because it's not important right now, but that was one of the key, I think, issues which not only I as a researcher found that, but many people I interviewed, they actually came to the same conclusion that it was during the transition from Jitu's leadership to the other person that took over the helm in the late 70s that really spelled the decline of the East and Uhuru Sasa.
Right. And, you know, and in discussion, I guess, a few weeks ago, I had Baba Ajay and Baba Hannibal on. And the following week, I had Baba Sanyika on. But in the discussion with Baba Hannibal and Baba Ajay, we began to discuss a little bit about this whole notion of administrators or elders or heads of institutions, and how if they are not themselves connected to some sense of an African paradigm, an African spiritual tradition themselves, in many instances are still stuck in, I guess, ideologies or philosophies or paradigms that haven't evolved into where we are today, that it sort of filters down into the institution, and sometimes the institutions, that is the reason why the institutions either close or have, you know, major issues, you know. And so in tying that into your book, how do you see, from whatever research that you've done, how have you seen that to be some of the issues with other larger CB institutions? I mean, those in the 70s and the 80s and 90s and, you know, even some today.
Well, definitely. And that's a critical question to ask, because I found that in the research on the East, which I think folks, if they enjoyed the first edition, the second edition, I think, will be much more, it's expanded, it's revised, and I think I've kind of clarified and, you know, add some more substance to it. So in the revised edition, you know, I tried to flush out, you know, some of the internal dynamics of the people who are part of the central organizing of the East. And for those people who are central to the East, you know, there was a, you know, kind of internal battle going on about ideology, as you mentioned, or ideology, and about spirituality. In fact, you know, the paradox is that, you know, many people left the East during this leadership transition to become either part of the Nation of Islam, to become a part of the Osar Set Society, to become a part of the Akan and the Yoruba tradition, respectively. So in these people leaving and seeking out these particular institutions of spiritual religious value, I think it points to the very, you know, challenge of the East, in that the East never sought to become a religion. Like many people saw Karenga's organization, US organization, which are based over in the West Coast, you know, in L.A., many people saw Karenga's US and its main philosophy, Kawieta, as a religion. And this is in the East documents. I mean, the documents bear it out and the interviews bear them out. People were very much, you know, fanatically attached to it. And perhaps the best evidence across the waters from Brooklyn in Newark is Amir Baraka's
Baraka
for United Newark, which was CFUN, which basically was an imitation, you know, direct imitation of Karenga's US organization. And Baraka said this in both his editions of his autobiography, that, you know, he was fanatical in his, you know, attachment to Kawieta, which is Karenga's fashion philosophy of African tradition and reason, according to that philosophy. So many people try not to be like Karenga. In fact, the East, I think, was, you know, much more egalitarian and therefore less dogmatic and less, you know, built around a personality. And for that is a plus. But on the flip side, it meant that because they chose not to be a religious organization of some kind, they didn't really pursue, you know, a particular spiritual philosophy or overarching philosophy of spiritual value that would kind of bind them together. And I think that was part of their challenge, because clearly when people left, they left to find that very same thing which they couldn't find at the East.
That's a very good point. Wow, go ahead, please.
Oh, excuse me, but so I think it's a very important balance, because I don't think the East got it wrong. I just think they, you know, it was a balancing act, because they didn't want to be dogmatic and, you know, built around a personality, you know, in terms of a cult, which, you know, arguably, you know, you could have looked at us in the 70s and 60s as US organization. However, at the same time, by not, you know, going that way, you know, they chose, therefore, not to entertain ideas about having a spiritual or spiritual philosophy anchoring the organization. So, in a sense, they're not trying to be dogmatic, but in going to extremes, they didn't reach the balancing point of not being dogmatic, but also being grounded in a particular, you know, spiritual philosophy that would actually, you know, provide the sustenance that people were looking for in their personal lives, beyond institutions, beyond when the school opened and closed, and beyond the Sunday Karamu. People need something that was, you know, personal they could actually, you know, value and believe in.
So do you think this is the same notion can be applied to other CB institutions in terms of its leadership or families and members that were, I guess, afraid is not the right word, but I guess had some intrepidation about connecting to an African spiritual tradition in relation to it being like, I guess, the the construct of the institution. What I'm seeing is that there are many institutions that came through CB in the 70s and 80s that had a cultural or a cultural nationalist platform, but many of them were lacking a spiritual platform. And in most instances, if they had one, it was an amalgamated platform, whereas it was, you know, some sort of African, sort of Asian, some amalgamation of many, you know, a sort of Christian or Islamic. But do you think that that was one of the major reasons why many of the institutions, aside from economics, of course, were, you know, eventually closed?
Well, that's a very important question, and I think the answer to the question is not simply about adopting a spiritual system per se or a spiritual philosophy, because that's not the answer either. I think the answer is in, you know, having a grounding in one whereby it connects people and allows people, you know, strategies for, you know, affirming, you know, who they are at a deep part of them, you know, binding the community that much stronger. And I think this is the key lesson that, you know, CB, I would think, would have learned over the past, you know, 30-some-odd years, maybe pushing 40 years or so, is that many people sought to actually build schools first. And what we've come to realize is that that was a bit, you know, misguided, because we had to build a community first and then let the school come out of the community, because I think people left the East in the late 70s because, you know, though there was a strong institutional culture, there wasn't really a strong community, I think, culture that bound people beyond the institution. In other words, you know, people gave their lives to the East. There's no question about that. I mean, there was a saying that the East Hour was, you know, 25-8, you know, 8 days a week and 25 hours a day. You know, people worked. I mean, and there was also 70s and 60s, which I think was very true for the East, in that Kazi's the blackest of them all, that work is the blackest of them all, to say that, you know, you measure your blackness in the amount of effort you gave. So people work without question. That's unquestioned. But I think when people work, like you and I, they get exhausted. They need to be replenished. They need periodic affirmation. They need periodic celebration. Beyond Nguza Saba, which I think are fine as a institutional value system, but I think people need, you know, something connective to a creative force, the ancestry, and to bind them to that kind of community. So I think people need institutional culture, but they also need a spiritual culture, and I don't think it's either or. I think you need both and.
Right.
And in having both, I think you begin to kind of forge, you know, the economic structures that you had mentioned a moment ago that would make sense. For example, you know, the 70s, they had rent parties. People would throw parties, you know, in the apartment to save another people from getting evicted. You know, that's community.
Right.
That's family.
Right.
And it's also spiritual based, too, because you're tied to people beyond the doors of the institution. You know, some people, they were East members at the East while the doors were open, but, you know, other contexts, you know, it was more the superficial in terms of their responses and their, you know, connection to people. And I think that's what's really key here. So I don't think having a spiritual system or not having one is the answer, but I think, you know, in having one, you have a, you know, a better, you know, sense of forging a community culture that is spiritually based, that is grounded in, you know, affirming people's value and worth, and giving them outlets, you know, for celebrating and for, you know, even crying, you know, having a safe place to bleed. You know, many leaders of the time, you know, who did they turn to? They couldn't, because if they turned to someone, you know, that would make them look weak and ineffective. They had to have this cold exterior, you know, at all times.
Yeah.
You know, kind of
mechanical,
you know, ineffective, because that was the, you know, prototype of leadership, that you unwavered. You know, you were national 24 hours. And so I think that was unrealistic. People are people. You know, we need to cry sometimes. Sometimes we need, you know, we need to need an embrace. Sometimes we need a safe place to bleed, so folks, you know, bleed, you know, heal from it and move on. I think having a spiritual base and a strong institutional culture together, and therefore having some economic strategies to support the both, because spirituality can't, you know, no matter how sophisticated it is, it doesn't feed you. So we need to have institutional cultures that are strong, spiritually based, that complement institutional culture and that grounds it. And then, you know, out of the two, we need economic strategies that support the two. So, for example, if your value system, let's say, comes out of a, you know, Yoruba or a Khan or a Vudum or whatever system that may be, you know, your economic structure should complement and reflect those. For example, you know, you shouldn't be selling, you know, perms or you know, goofy dust or those kinds of things, because it doesn't support your institutional and spiritual culture. So you engage in economic enterprises that support them, and that actually, you know, reflects, you know, who you are, institution, and who the members are as a composite. And I think that formula may work better, at least from what I've seen, than simply, you know, seeing folks, whether measuring folks whether they have or don't have a spiritual system as a part of the organization.
Most certainly. You know, in the 10 philosophical questions that I asked, that I came up with in the article that I wrote in the Sankofa Journal, philosophical questions to consider when founding an IBI. And one of the question number 9 was, does the institution have a viable, independent, African-centered economic arm that assists in the continuum, the Ujamaa of the institution, and that is conducive to the community's cultural needs? You know, so, you know, same thing with, you know, same thing, and essentially what you're saying is that, you know, the school needs to have some kind of economic arm that is supporting what they're doing and supporting the mission. You know, for example, our institution, and I think you were there at a school, maybe, I think you were there, but, you know, when we sell items, the items are reflective of what we are producing in our institution. And I think sometimes people miss that point, and they just feel as though we don't eat candy in our school, but yet we'll have candy sales. Mm-hmm. To raise money, those kind of things, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's a very good point. I appreciate that. I just wanted to add on to that. But, you know, I want to switch gears real quick, and I want to have you talk a little bit about your experience as a co-executive officer, I think how many years were you co-executive officer?
You know, you may have to help me out there.
I
think about 6, maybe 7 years.
Yeah, I remember. I was going to say 6 years, but
yeah,
I think it was supposed to be how many years?
We'll go with 6.
Okay, well, how many years was it supposed to be?
Well, you know, I think you don't answer that very well. I think we were told that is Yatantu and myself were told, you know, I think 2 years, but you know.
Oh, okay.
You know that very well. So.
exactly. But I think my Rickette and I are going on, I think our 3rd year maybe, so. But it's all good. But I want to talk a little bit, you know, tell the listeners about your experience as, you know, co-executive officer of the Council of Independent Black Institutions, but also talk a little bit about how much of a learning experience it was working with, you know, elders of, you know, people who have been involved in a movement for, like, for example, Baba Hannibal for over 40 years or so, and just, you know, how that has supported you in your mission and your work that you're doing now.
Well, another excellent question. If I can think back to the experience, I think the experience was certainly something that I didn't anticipate. I was at a meeting in St. Helena Island, I think Frogmore, South Carolina, at Penn Center. You know, historically where CB was founded in 1972. And at this meeting, I went there as simply just someone who was helping CB through its their national office at McGriffith College when Dr. Mwalimu Shuja was the executive officer and was based at that college. So I was helping out, you know, the institution that way. And so I went to the meeting and came that at the meeting there was a stalemate, so to speak, because Baba Shuja at the time wasn't sure how he was going to break the news that he was transitioning from the leadership of CB to other endeavors and onto someone else. And, you know, we had a large discussion. And now I'm on the periphery. And then, you know, in the discussion, I made a suggestion. And next thing I know, I was one of the person that was slated to be nominated for what was then this dual leadership, which was new to CB, because CB had never had, you know, a male-female complementary leadership, and that was really key. And I think it was revolutionary at the time because, and even now, because most nationalist or, you know, culturally based organizations really have this kind of, you know, I think, if I can say the word, youthful and complementary in terms of gender balance, but also buttressed or surrounded by, you know, a strong group of elders who, as you noted, you know, have several decades of of experience and expertise under their belt. So we were buttressed by this, and so we were not alone. But I think CB was experimental, but I think was very courageous in making the step because it hasn't been done before. And I think the experience that I had with Yasanta was and the elders there was key in several respects. One respect was that it really allowed us to show, you know, the elders and the members what we could do as quote unquote young folks.
Right.
And I think we demonstrated that through, you know, effort. I remember we organized the annual science exposition in D.C. and with I think 6 or 5 weeks notice, which was really, you know, a longer story. But the short end of it is that, you know, that was one of the best expos we had in years in terms of what people were saying. You know, it was well organized. Folks came in there. I mean, directions were clear. The organization in terms of the procedure and itinerary executed well. The students, I mean, they had a wonderful time. The judges, I mean, everything clicked and went together. The banquet went off well. People, you know, really had, I think, a very substantive time. And, you know, we came out in the black in terms of the income.
Right.
Usually, we come out in the red because people, including the, you know, who are part of the executive council, you know, dish out monies in form of dues, and institutions dish out money as well. So it was important in several respects because it really gave us, I think, legitimacy, so to speak. You know, our young folks were given the opportunity. And secondly, you know, it really gave us a chance, you know, to really demonstrate to the elders that, you know, we are confident and competent young people. And so from that point on, you know, we really had, I think, a few bumps along the way in terms of procedure and in terms of being exhausted. But I think more and more, I think 85% of our tenure, I think, was very positive. I think we helped the organization, I think, to move ahead in terms of, you know, clarifying what it is and who it is. And I think in doing that, you know, the elders were tremendous in terms of, you know, the guidance and support, because clearly we couldn't have done it without the elders' support, nor the members' support. We couldn't have done it. So if I would summarize the experience, I think it is, for those folks who are listening, and they're in the category of youth, I guess that would be what, 20s to late 30s, that it's important for them to really, you know, get the opportunity but get the support, you know, of those people who are elder, because elders are not getting any younger, and they have to have, you know, processes, even sometimes, you know, forcibly, you know, put upon them to move, you know, younger folks, but not simply because they're young, but because they're confident and they're competent and able to do the work, and to guide them, but also support them. You know, when they make a mistake, call them out, but also support them when they do well. You know, and I think that kind of balanced approach was key for us. You know, if we made a mistake, you know, the elders would call us out, you know, and we took it. But if we did well, you know, they would praise us, and that was wonderful, because the praise, I think, sometimes, you know, just nullify 10 negatives, you know. No matter how much you messed up in terms of not calling people for the meeting, but, you know, you made sure that everyone was acknowledged for, you know, a particular task. The elders say, wonderful job. They praise you. So that's the kind of eldership I think we encountered. I think that's the kind of eldership that people may want to aspire to in terms of, you know, transitioning leadership to younger folks who are competent and who are committed.
All right. Well, I think we're right at our midpoint, brother. We're going to take a break here for Harambe listeners. You are listening to The Liberated Zone with your host, Baye Kemet, and I have with me tonight Dr. Kwesi Kanadu, and we will be back after the break.
Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working
together
for
progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there. Keep it right there.
Attention, parents, teachers, students, and educators. Have you set high high expectations and goals for achievement? Are you meeting those expectations? Let the Transformation Network, LLC, an educational advocacy and consulting company, help you. The Transformation Network team has years of proven experience in law, education, business, and advocacy. We want to inform you that we now offer online tutoring service for students 1st grade through 12th. Educational software and books targeting mathematics, science, and our story, and more. The Transformation Network is a socially responsible company that understands the challenges children and adults face when attaining educational goals. Please visit our website at www.theultimatelifechange.com or call 410-209-9687 in Baltimore. Or Maryland, D.C., call 202-213-3141. We hope to see you at our upcoming community event in Baltimore Saturday, June 20th. At Washington, D.C., at the Charter School Conference, Saturday, June 27th. In Baltimore, call 410-209-9687. In D.C., or Maryland, call 202-213-3141. Or on the web at www.theultimatelifechange.com.
This is Delani Amon thanking you for listening to Harambe Radio. Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working together for progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
All right, Harambe listeners, you are back live with the Liberated Zone, your host, Baye Kemet, and I'm here with my guest tonight, Brother Dr. Kwesi Kanadu. And we were having a discussion on the first part of the show, discussing, you know, African-centered education. We were discussing the history of CB and Brother Kwesi's book, Truth Crushed to the Earth Will Rise Again, which is a historical analysis of the East Organization, or Uhuru Sasa, and we were basically just talking about the ins and outs of his research and some of the things that he learned, in addition to being co-executive officer of CB. And on the second half of the show, we want to talk a little bit, we want to switch gears and talk a little bit about some of the other works that Brother Kwesi has done. And I have a book that's sitting right in front of me that I purchased from you called Indigenous Medicine and Knowledge in African Society. And, you know, I've skimmed it thus far. I can't quite say I read it all the way, but you know, I picked apart a few chapters, what have you. This is one of the type of books you got to start from the beginning. You know, sometimes you try to get a book and you jump in the middle of it, mm-hmm. or you may come from behind. But this is a book you got to, you know, you have to go from the beginning. And at least in my estimation, you know. But it's a well documented book and a well researched book, I must say, like all your books are, brother. So, you know, if you can, man, just, you know, give us a little again, a little history on the book and how you came about, you know, this topic, and what are some of the things that you know, we were trying to, I guess, present and trying to get across in doing this book.
Well, definitely. Let me first say that the Truth Crushed to the Earth book is no longer available, and there's a newer version that's been expanded and revised, and the title of that one is A View from the East, and actually that one will be out end of this month or early next month through Syracuse University Press. So folks who are interested in finding Truth Crushed to Earth, they won't find that book because it's not available anymore. But The View from the East is a expanded and revised version of that book. Now, the current book on Indigenous knowledge.
Let me just say, I still have 3 copies of it, but go ahead. That's another issue.
Well, you have a collector's item then.
Yes, exactly. I'm not going to sell them now, but go ahead, brother.
Yeah, but actually, there's some folks on eBay who are selling them for $300, so.
You know, that's great.
Find, yes. So you might find someone who is interested. Anyway, the more recent book on medicine, Indigenous knowledge, and African society, that book, that came out of, you know, my personal family history. My maternal grandfather was what we call in Chi Odunchini, or herbalist. He was a healer in the part of Jamaica where Marcus Garvey is from. And, yes, mm-hmm. St. Anne's Bay around the area, St. Anne's Bay, Runaway Bay, Olcharias, in that vicinity. And so, as a healer, I grew up with my grandfather. And, you know, much of the rituals he did, much of the, activities I was a part of, either observing or participating. And so, you know, I value that time, and I tell folks that, you know, I'm thankful to my grandfather because he wasn't a Christian or Muslim or the like. And, you know, I value that because, you know, I pride myself in not being able to, you know, recite a hymn or or the like, because that's not my experience. And I think, but not having that kind of, you know, filter, you know, I think I can see and be able to, you know, make sense of the world in a, from a different perspective than most folks could. I think most folks, particularly of African, you know, diasporic communities here in North America or in the Caribbean, many of them tend to see the world through a largely, I think, dogmatic Christian lens, and I think that clouds much of what they see and don't see, and therefore what they do and don't do. So from that, I thank my grandfather for that. And so in thanking him, you know, I went ahead and actually began looking at medicine and healing, because it became an interest of mine through this personal attachment to my grandfather, who was a healer. And so since part of my family, my maternal family, ancestry is in what is now Ghana, the former Gold Coast, I began to do that research in Ghana. And incidentally, I wasn't led to Ghana by a book or an, you know, document. I actually had a dream where I was told if I wanted to know more about my great-great-great-grandmother, I had to go to Ghana. And that's how I went to Ghana my first trip in 2001. And from there, the research started. You know, so it was a combination of personal, you know, interest, motivation, and, you know, really looking at this idea of medicine and knowledge systems in African society, and choosing, you know, one Akan society among the Bono people in a place called Techiman, which is in central Ghana today. Now, from doing the research, you know, there's much, I mean, much, much, much to talk about in terms of what I found, but I think one of the key, you know, themes that I found was the ways in which, you know, these healers, you know, saw reality and saw healing. Many of them, you know, saw healing as being one that was at once spiritual, you know, psychosomatic or psychological, physical, and the medicines that were used were mainly plant-based medicines, but they were used in a way that, you know, you had to know the patient's family history. That was first. Mm-hmm. Because disease has a history, and disease is located with using the context of family. Secondly, healers of, you know, righteous character, and there was a standard of code, which I wasn't aware of before the research, that people operated from. And so the healers that were of quality and high caliber, they never charged. The people who received their service would actually provide certain gifts in the form of chicken, you know, a few eggs. But they never charged. And this is really the I think, the key ethical point, because I think, you know, the pictures of Tarzan and, you know, Africans with bones in their nose and, you know, big pots and, you know, cannibalism, I think these pictures still, I think, pervade people's mind about, you know, African reality, particularly when it comes to spirituality.
Right.
And, you know, what I found was that you have a very ethically driven, morally based, you know, vocation that was very righteous, that had an honor code. And I think people miss the theme of honor in African history. You know, when people think of honor, they think about, you know, these Chinese movies where you avenge someone's death based on honor, you know, and therefore Chinese people have honor.
Right.
However, when the Chinese go to their ancestors' grave and offer food, that's seen as being sophisticated and cultured. When an African does that, it's barbaric and primitive.
Right.
And so, you know, in doing this book, I think, you know, I wanted to, you know, really teach through the experiences of those healers, you know, about, you know, what it meant to be a healer and how they translate their conceptualization of medicine and healing into social practice. And how did that practice help to, you know, deal with people's social, psychological, spiritual illnesses, you know, in a way that is very holistic and in a way that incorporates not only organic plant life but also inorganic materials such as what people may call the shrines or the spiritual entities, which they kind of refer to as the Abusum, the Yoruba, as the Orisha and Lowers, and et cetera.
Right. Now, in your research, how have you been able to connect, I guess, in terms of the indigenous medicine in Jamaica or even in Ghana to those that have been transported over here to the New World?
Well, there's actually a chapter on the medicines themselves where I try to be innovative. I did a cultural linguistic but also a biochemical analysis of the actual physical plant medicines that were the most frequently used by healers in the Techiman district where I did the research. And in doing so, you know, I saw many of the connections in West Africa and also in the Caribbean. In fact, that chapter, I think chapter 4 and the last chapter, you know, looks at broadly some of the African diasporic traditions of using, you know, medicinal plants and medicine. And I think even in the U.S. South, particularly where most, you know, African folks were before the early 20th century when there was two great migrations up to the north. And so thematically, you know, the conceptions were similar. That is, there wasn't a divide between the temporal and the spiritual. They were seen as being continuities of one. And therefore, in order to heal or to address misfortune or disease, you had to have someone who was skilled in both worlds. So you had to know the physical plant medicine, but you also had to know how to deal with these spiritual entities, you know, that many times teach you about and therefore, you know, facilitate healing. And I think, you know, that theme is very critical because we talked about earlier in terms of the East organization and people's, you know, affront to spirituality. You know, I think many times folks' pursuit of being African, in quotation, I think they missed the part that the spiritual and temporal is a continuum. So you can't just be African in terms of the incense and the kente cloth and not be African in terms of the spiritual concepts and practices that come along with it.
That's right.
There's a continuity between the two. And so I think, you know, this book on the medicine in particular, for those interested in diasporic medicine, I think you see a lot of parallels. I know my family in Jamaica, many of the, you know, plants and herbs we use, they are parallels. In fact, the plants I know that have the tree name still in Jamaica. And I'm sure in Barbados, where I was for two occasions, a friend of mine was an herbalist there. We found similar names for plants when he saw my book. So I think much more broader in the Caribbean, North America, particularly in the South, I think folks will find parallels in plants, the usages, and how people, you know, thought about them and their usage in terms of, you know, personal and collective healing.
And so in your new book, give the title of the new book, The Akans, and give it, please, brother.
Sure. The forthcoming book is entitled The Akan Diaspora in the Americas.
And so in your new book, can you just tell the listeners some of the, you know, essentially just a brief breakdown of the book?
Sure. The Book of the Medicines is a history of the present. That is, I take a snapshot look at a community of healers and indigenous knowledge systems in Ghana during the present decade. In the new book, I actually look more broadly from about the 17th century onward to the present. And there I try to chart the story of the Akan peoples in terms of how their culture and society formed in the West African forest, on the fringes as well as towards the coast. And
right.
I argue that that culture was based in a spiritual culture, because I define culture on three levels: spiritual, ideational, or mental, and material, physiological. And that composite called culture, I argue that the spiritual culture is the kind of like the parent. It is the cosmological understandings that people have about themselves. And through those understandings, they create ideational, that is, thought systems, languages, and physical, housing, weapons, utensils, base culture, so that they can live life. And so, based on definition, I argue that the Akan culture between the fringe of the forest, the top of the forest, which is about 8 degrees, I think, latitude, to the coast of Ghana, which hits the Atlantic seaboard, was calibrated roughly from about 1500 BCE up until they encountered the Portuguese in the 15th century. And it was that culture that I think helped the Akan not to be either Christian, though the Akan had long interactions with many of the European Christians, whether they be Dutch, British, Portuguese, German, etc. And the Akan had long commercial and cultural contacts with Muslims, but they never became Islamic. So I argue that it was a spiritual culture and people's, you know, attachment to it that, you know, forestalled them from becoming Muslim or becoming Christian like other people. And
right.
So they brought that spiritual culture into the Americas, and that's why you find the Akan, whether it's Suriname, Jamaica, Antigua, the former, you know, Danish colonies, which are now the U.S. Virgin Islands, as well as the U.S. South, Georgia in particular, South Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, and New York, including some parts north, such as Rhode Island. That these are the places where common people were primarily found. And in that, these places, thematically, they were in smaller numbers, but their numbers, you know, they outshined their numbers by being key people in revolts, being key people in spiritual, you know, based communities, and being key people in shaping identity through names. One of the key things that I found is that Akan names have survived, you know, up until the 20th century, particularly in the South, where you find, you know, phonetic English versions of Kwabena, Kofi, right, which is one of the most popular names. Few women names like Ama and Afia are there, which usually are four. In the Caribbean, Kwashi takes the place of my name, which is Kwesi. Those are still there. In fact, in the Caribbean, I know people whose last name or surname are Akan names. In fact,
wow,
you know, one young girl who was a classmate of our seven-year-old, her name is Sabrina Kwashi, you know, and she's from the Caribbean.
Wow.
And many people, in fact, I was in Trinidad and Tobago at the airport looking through the phone book, you know, had some time to waste. And you see the name. People's last name are now Kwabena. Last names are Kwashi. Last names are Kwaku.
Right.
You know? And in fact, as you know, the early nationalist, Paul Cuffey, his father, his name was Cuffey, who was a captive Asante person that was brought into the Massachusetts Boston area in the 18th century.
Right. I will mention Paul Cuffey. That's very interesting. Go ahead, continue.
Indeed. And so, you know, I end the book by looking at, you know, this issue of diasporic discourses. That is, African diasporic people and Akan people are meeting with the ancestors of both have left, which is the slave castles on the coast, which is the irony. They meet there. But when they meet there, they have two different interpretations. The African diasporic community sees these castles as sacred ground because the ancestors, you know, rightfully had suffered, bled, died, and was deported at these sites.
Right.
Many people in Ghana, Akan and non-Akan, particularly the coastal Fanti peoples and others, they see these castles as, you know, revenue, as commercial and tourism, you know, sites. And therefore,
right,
you have two different interests here and two different divergent interpretations, which is key. Also, many Akan people are leaving Ghana for Europe, particularly Britain, and North America, particularly North America and Canada. In fact, in New York City, there are more than 20,000 people who are Asante people, Akan peoples. And they're becoming increasingly Christianized, unlike prior centuries, whereby diasporic Africans are beginning to, from the Caribbean and North America, are going to Ghana since the 60s, before Nkrumah was overthrown. And they're adopting the Akan spirituality. So these are the kind of divergent movements in the diaspora. And so I kind of look at these, you know, movements of people, how they engage and disengage from culture, and try to, you know, formulate some ideas around that theme of diaspora discourse.
And do you mention Namdi Zulu and his work with the Akan people
indeed,
here in America?
In fact, the last chapter, he's there, and I have a section on Kwabena from D.C.
Ashe. What about Nation House, Uncle Bia Society?
No, I didn't look at that. I think that's some more. I didn't become that personal. I chose on Kwabena as kind of like emblematic of the, you know, looking at a personal story to reflect a larger story.
Gotcha.
So I looked at his story in particular without being too personal. I think if I chose them or Nipa Busia or other people who averse, you know, part of these so-called shrine houses, then I think it become more personal, but I didn't want to go there because I didn't see it being necessary.
Right.
Indeed, I did. I focused on the Nzulu because his role is critical. His role, I think, is similar to the role of a surgeon for the Yoruba tradition in the 60s. The 50s and 60s, I should say.
Right.
You know, in fact, they were close buddies and very, very close.
That's right.
I know Katabia from Ghana. I look at her as well in terms of, you know, the early formations.
And, you know, and so in closing, we probably have about another, I guess, about 8 minutes or so.
You know, I want to ask you, how can we as African people use the Akan tradition or the Yoruba tradition or even the Vodou tradition that that we're practicing either on the continent or here in America to position ourselves to, I guess, not necessarily get out of the situation that we're in, but to begin to reclaim some sense of sovereignty for ourselves?
Well, I think that's a critical question because, you know, from where I stand in 2009 and probably the early part of 2010, you know, African peoples over the world, and by that I mean, you know, I've done, you know, research and work in Brazil, in the Caribbean, certainly North America, parts of Europe, as well as in five West African countries. And so when I look broadly at the African world, you know, this is one of the main paradoxes I see, is that African people's culture, wherever they are, you know, has significantly, you know, spread across the world, has been marketed. Many people have profited and still are profiting from it. And so African people have a large cultural influence, but they have no political power.
Right.
And so therefore, they can't determine the course nor the contour of their own cultural productions, whether it is spiritual or otherwise. In fact, in Brazil, you have traditions like the Xango tradition in Pernambuco. You have the Ubanda tradition in Rio de Janeiro, or Rio de Janeiro, towards the south from Bahia. And you would have these African-based traditions, you know, have largely middle-class or upper-class, you know, white Brazilian clientele.
Right.
You have, you know, even in Europe tradition, you know, in North America, where not only persons who are of various sexual orientation, but also non-African descended persons who have key positions as Babalao, etc. And I think,
right,
you know, the culture, again, the cultural influence is pervasive and broad, whereby people, you know, who have no ancestral attachment or, you know, claim to these traditions are very much, you know, in the forefront of not only practicing, but speaking on its behalf. So at conferences,
right,
you know, you
right,
really see people who are, you know, of African, you know, or African diasporic, you know, identity, who are actually, you know, projecting what these spiritual traditions are and should be, and, you know, the contours of them. So I think the paradox of cultural influence worldly, but, you know, poverty of political power to determine that culture, I think is probably the key. So in terms of, you know, issues of freedom and sovereignty, you know, people have to find ways in which to get control of these cultural productions in such a way that, you know, they begin to, I think, yield what Marcus Garvey talked about, you know, almost a century ago. That is, you know, people have to begin asserting, you know, their political, you know, ownership over these cultural productions, and using those cultural productions in such a way that, you know, they won't make money for you, and they shouldn't, and they won't get you in political office, and they shouldn't. But, you know, these, you know, I think spiritual traditions should be used, you know, to create institutional and community control, whereby that gives you a certain level of political power where you live. So, for example,
right,
the East could have very well, you know, adopted not one or two spiritual traditions, but simply, you know, a broad-based understanding that would allow them to incorporate various kinds of people under an umbrella to say, hey, we could have a Pan-African, you know, understanding,
yeah,
whereby people of that umbrella could be Yoruba, could be Akan, could be Voodoo, could be et cetera, but they have a you know, commitment to the broader Pan-African ideal. And I think that's where Pan-African comes in, that it's a political ideology understanding, no more than that. It's the way,
right,
to politically organize people who are in, you know, diverse and discrete parts of the world of African descent and share a certain level of connectedness. So I think that's where Pan-African comes in, to give it the political shape. And I think that will be, I think, key to looking at issues of spirituality and sovereignty, that it has to be some way in which to, you know, surround that spiritual practice with some, you know, concrete political power. And I don't mean electoral policy, but just being able to control the institutions, the flow of capital, and how you and your cultural productions are interpreted in your community and therefore in the world.
Ashe. All right. We have about 3 minutes, brother. You have any closing remarks, man? Anything, you know, you want the listeners to know, any way they can get in contact with you or be able to get to purchase your books or any information you want to give, please.
Okay, well certainly, I want to, you know, definitely say thank you again for inviting me on the show.
I really appreciate it.
And if folks, you know, want to talk more or want to get more information or the like, they can certainly reach me by email, which would be kwasini@yahoo.com. That's kwasini@yahoo.com. Or at our website at www.nkoso.com. That's www.nkoso.com. Nkoso.com.
All right, Ashe. And, you know, just before we get off, man, I just wanted to, you know, again, thank you for coming on the show, brother. And, you know, thank you for continuing to do the work that you're doing, you know, as a member of CB, but also as a, you know, just as a brother in the struggle, you know, in the movement, I would say, you know, that, your work is always above par, man. Your work is always top notch. Your research is always top notch. And, you know, the angle in which you present your work is always top-notch, you know. You know, you didn't just do a historical analysis of the East Organization, but you really looked at some key points in the book and really, you know, and really brought it out in a special kind of way, man. So, I always promote the book. Everywhere I go, everywhere I lecture, you know what I'm saying, I hold the book up and I always promote, you know, that book because, for me, it is very clear and cogent. And a precise argument that you're presenting in the, but not necessarily argument, but you know, research that you're presenting in the book, man. So, again, I want to thank you, and I want to just give you light, love, and blessings, brother, on your work and all of your endeavors, man.
Definitely appreciate it, man.
Ashe. So next week, listeners, the Liberated Zone, I will have Obaseku Olayinka on the show. If many remember, the very first week of the show, I had his father. Obalumi Ogunseye is Baba Lao out of Philadelphia. And when you mentioned Osurgima earlier, his father was, in and around that time period with Nana Denizulu and many others. In fact, if I can recall correctly, he met Kabiyesi Ibashe in about 1962, or maybe even earlier than that. And then I know that he got initiated in 1967. And so Baba Sekou's father was probably number one in terms of African Americans or Africans from America, or, you know, in terms of practicing the tradition in Philadelphia. And he and his family are the founders and of the Odunde Festival and what have you. And so, you know, I'm going to have Obaseku on next week, and we'll be discussing, you know, the Yoruba tradition, Africans in education, sovereignty, and many of the things that we're discussing tonight. And Harambe listeners, tomorrow from 7 to 10, there will be a special three-hour show on Brother Ken Bridges, who was the founder of My Time Network, so you definitely want to tune in for that. And again, the Liberated Zone, every Monday at 9 p.m. with your host, Baye Kemet. And tonight, my guest was Brother Dr. Kwesi Kanadu. And again, I want to say Asante Sana for coming on the show, brother, and we definitely want to have you again.
All right, then. Appreciate it, brother.
All right, Harambe listeners, peace and blessings. I share all.